This document was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's University Law Student Volunteers. PBSC volunteers are not lawyers and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. This document contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Good morning and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Kiss. This is Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio, where we discuss interesting and off-center legal topics to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is about Gladue reports and the intersectionality of sentencing. Before we begin the show, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territories upon which this show is produced. As a son of two immigrants, I understand the importance of cultural heritage, as well as respecting the privilege of being able to call myself a Canadian citizen. However, none of this is to diminish the colonial lineage of this great country, but rather to meditate and consider the history we all share by living here today, and to acknowledge this past, not only understanding it and how we got to where we are today, but to think about how we can all move forward together. Being an essential component of today's episode, I think it would be prudent to discuss what a Gladue report is. Under Section 718.2e of the Criminal Code, it states that all available sanctions other than imprisonment that are reasonable in the circumstances and consistent with the harm done to the victims or to the community should be considered for all offenders with particular attention to the circumstances of Aboriginal offenders. After the finding of the 1999 case of Artie Gladue, it was recognized that a larger effort should be made in respecting this section to curb the increasing rate of incarceration amongst the Indigenous accused. As such, Gladue reports were created. Gladue reports are pre-sentence reports that represent the history and cultural elements of an Indigenous accused in the hope of adhering to a more restorative justice-based sentence. I understand this might be a tad vague, but I'm hoping that by the end of today, we'll all leave with a slightly better understanding of what a Gladue report is and how they function within our legal system. Joining us now is Professor Lisa Kerr. Professor Kerr is currently an assistant professor at Queen's University specializing in criminal law sentencing and prison law. In addition to receiving the SSHRC grant in 2019 to study fit sentencing for racialized defendants, Professor Kerr also serves as the director of the criminal law group at Queen's Law. Professor Kerr, thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of Pro Bono Radio.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's great to have a chance to talk with you today.
So, Professor Kerr, I think it'd be nice if we discussed first about the judicial system and how sentencing works within it. What would you say that the principles of sentencing are within Canada?
Right. So the principles of sentencing are set out in the Criminal Code. So in Canada, at least since 1996, these things have been codified. They've been part of the legislation of criminal law. And so if you look at Section 718 of the Criminal Code, you'll see principles like deterrence, denunciation, restitution, rehabilitation. So all of those things are what we would call the principles or purposes of sentencing in Canada. What's interesting is that sentencing judges are basically allowed to sort of pick from those purposes. In a particular case, a sentencing judge might decide that the purpose of deterrence is particularly important, right? And she might decide that because there seems to be a high prevalence of that particular offense in her region. I always say in my class that the principles of sentencing are kind of like a menu, and that the judge can order from the menu whatever items she wants that day. But the one thing that has to be ordered every meal is what we call the principle of proportionality. So Section 718.1 of the Criminal Code says that every sentence, regardless of those purposes, right, whether it's deterrent or more rehabilitative, that it has to be a proportionate sentence. So proportionality in Canada means a sentence that is commensurate with the degree of responsibility of the offender and the seriousness of the offense. So the way I put it is deterrence, rehabilitation, denunciation, restitution, those are items on the menu. But no matter what meal the judge orders, she has to order a beer with it. And the beer is proportionality. So no sentence can be a disproportionate sentence. right? And proportionality is defined by these two things: looking at the offender, right, the person being sentenced, what is their degree of culpability? And I know we're going to return to this idea a lot in our discussion today. What is the, and that requires us to think about the circumstances of this person, right? What was going on for them when they committed the offense? What's going on in their life? And then also, what was the offense and how serious was it, right? So things like, you know, an assault that's accompanied by racial bias is a more serious form of assault. So we're always going to try and craft a sentence that's responsive to the offense that was committed and the way in which it was committed.
Thank you for that. So regarding the seriousness of offenses, I think the media has often portrayed sentencing and incarceration as a typical end result. Could you elaborate onto like how rare incarceration really is within our system?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really important question, and it's one that doesn't often get asked. So if you look at, there's this really important report that gets published every year called the Corrections and Conditional Release Statistical Overview. It's published by Public Safety Canada, and you can go online and look at these reports, and it's a real treasure trove of data on the criminal justice system and sentencing in particular. So if we look at that report, I have the 2018 one in front of me, but there's a newer one out as well. In 2016 to 2017, the number of people found guilty in adult criminal court is 226,000. So that means, you know, adults convicted of a crime in Canada that year, over 200,000. So then you kind of go, okay, so how many of those people went into custody? Because that will answer the question, how prevalent is a sentence of incarceration? Well, that year there were 6,000 admissions into the federal prison system. So that means 6,000 of 226,000 received a sentence of longer than 2 years, because that's what it takes to go into federal prison, a sentence of longer than 2 years. And then if we look at the provincial system, at any given time, there is about 25,000 people. So we might say that 30,000 out of 226,000 about wound up in custody. So I would actually suggest to you that that is a fairly small proportion of people convicted of crimes that wind up in custody. So, and then your question kind of requires us to say, well, are there other kinds of criminal sanctions? And the answer is absolutely, right? You can have a fine, you can have probation, you can have various forms of house arrest and so on. There are lots of ways of doing, of imposing criminal sanctions that don't require sending someone into the physical custody of the state. And I would suggest actually that Canada is fairly restrained when it comes to using incarceration as a form of punishment. And we're fairly consistent too. Our rate of incarceration has been very steady, even through serious rises in crime that happened in the 1960s and 70s. So I would say Canada is fairly moderate and fairly consistent when it comes to our use of incarceration.
That's really interesting. So I guess a follow-up question then would be, so when does incarceration as a verdict occur? At what point with all these alternatives to it? When is it the almost sentence to fit, if you would?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. And I can't say that there's one crystal clear answer to that. What I could say is that, so another section in 718 of that criminal code is a really important section, is section 718.2 sub E. And we all kind of know that provision as the Gladue provision, but it's important to read the whole thing. And what the whole thing says is that judges should use restraint in the sanction of incarceration, that we should be restrained, that the sentence of incarceration is really when other sentences or forms of sanction are not appropriate. So we are really supposed, judges are supposed to be restrained. That's kind of principle number one. And then the rest of the provision says, especially with regard to the circumstances of Aboriginal offenders. So everyone is entitled to that principle of restraint. And then, you know, it's an additional thing that you're supposed to consider the circumstances of Aboriginal offenders. And that's kind of the Gladue jurisprudence. So we're supposed to be restrained with incarceration. Why is that? Because we understand how incredibly harsh and harmful and in many ways counterproductive and even criminogenic that sentence is. And so, you know, it really is when separation from society is what is required, right? Incapacitation, right? Removal is kind of what is required from a public safety standpoint. Having said that, right, there are long sentences of incarceration that are imposed on nonviolent first offenders who've committed an importing drugs offense, which is basically a crime of economic desperation in many, many circumstances. And we impose 6, 7, 8 year sentences, federal sentences on first offenders, depending on how much the weight of the drugs that they brought into the country. So my view as a scholar or as someone who cares about these issues is that we overuse the sentence of incarceration, and that when you're talking about people who've committed offenses in economic desperation, where they're first time offenders, where there's no indication that violence is part of how they react in the community, we overuse incarceration for those folks. And then there are other cases where you'd say, okay, there was a loss of life here, there was a violence component, there was a violation of bodily integrity component, and some period of separation from the community is called for. So, it's kind of a complicated answer, but I think those are some of the concerns that go into it and that should go into it.
See, that's interesting, especially when you consider that, I mean, the theme of today is consideration and all the factors that we take in. Could you maybe talk about the concept of fit sentencing and how it plays a role in it?
Yeah, that's a hugely important concept, right? The idea that what the sentencing judge's task is to impose a fit sentence. And if the sentence that's imposed is reviewed by an appellate court, the appellate court is also going to be looking at the question of fitness. So that's really the core governing principle in Canadian sentencing. And it's partly because our sentencing judges in Canada do have a lot of discretion, right? We don't have sentence guidelines like in some US jurisdictions. We have fairly few mandatory minimums. They get struck down every day. We've kind of had this big experiment with mandatory minimums, but they really haven't fared well in the courts. And so I think it's fair to say the sort of paradigmatic sentence in Canada is one that is imposed with a lot of judicial discretion. So this concept of fitness is really important. And it goes back to what I said before. Fitness is about proportionality. A fit sentence is a proportionate one. So it's one where the sanction, whatever it is, whether it's incarceration or house arrest or probation or a fine, that it matches, right? That it's commensurate with, that it's a fair, it, you know, stands in fair relation to the thing the person did, given the circumstances that they were in. So it's not just about what offense did they commit. It's what offense did they commit? How serious was it? What was the harm to the victim? But also, what was their mental state? Was it intentional? What were their life circumstances at the time? So all of that in Canada, we say, goes into the question of fitness. And we could have a different system, right? We could have a system where we understood fitness to be about only the offense. Right, that's really what a mandatory minimum is. It's saying we're going to look only at the offense and say you get 3 years for this kind of firearms offense. And we don't care what your circumstances were or why you were carrying that gun or how you grew up or what opportunities you had and what fears you had in life and so on. And that's really how mandatory minimums work. But the everyday, ordinary, sort of paradigmatic sentence in Canada is one where fitness involves looking at circumstances and offense. And it's one where our sentencing judges do have a lot of discretion.
So you can predict the follow-up questions already. I have one on mandatory minimums and different judicial systems. But before we get there, I was wondering, given the fact that the topic is Gladue reports, If you could speak, is this doctrine of fitness, is it different than that of Gladue reports, or are they sort of overlapping?
That's a great question, Kevin. And I think it's taken many, many years for the legal system to figure out the answer to that question. So we have this Gladue decision in the early 2000s, and then it took many years for lower courts to sort of struggle with what Gladue really meant. But if you look at the Ipeely decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, in that case, Justice LaBelle really makes clear that that search for a fit sentence is the exact same for an Indigenous defendant or for a non-Indigenous defendant. Fitness, commensurability, proportionality, all those are the concerns of Gladue in a Gladue sentencing, and those are the concerns in a so-called ordinary or, you know, non-Indigenous sentencing. Okay, so they're exactly the same. The sentencing judge has the same task in front of her. It's to impose a fit sentence. What Gladue says is that in searching for that fit sentence for an Indigenous person, we may, although not necessarily, but we may need to consider particular factors that may have come up in that person's life. So all Gladue is, and there's so much misunderstanding about this in my view, what Gladue is it says, hey judges, take judicial notice of certain systemic historic facts. What is judicial notice? Not many people know in first year law school, even third year law school, what is judicial notice? That's something you learn really in more depth in a civil procedure class, but it does come up in Gladue and first year criminal law. So judicial notice is basically a doctrine that says judges can consider something without hearing evidence on it. So let me back up a little bit. The normal rule in court is that if you're gonna make a claim, whether as a judge or a lawyer or whatever, about what facts in the world are, you have to hear evidence on it, right? A judge doesn't just get to say, I find as a fact that this happened on this day and therefore X, right? A judge has to hear from witnesses, right? A whole criminal trial is really nothing more than bringing in evidence, hearing from witnesses, whether it's in documentary form or through viva voce evidence about what happened. And then the judge hears all of that and decides for herself who was credible, who wasn't, what does the evidence show, what inferences can I make from the evidence, and so on. So the doctrine of judicial notice is basically saying judges don't have to hear evidence on everything. Okay, there are certain things that are so obvious, that are so uncontestable, that the judge can just say, I'll take judicial notice of that. So a standard example I use in my teaching is to say, if you have two witnesses who saw something, but one saw at 8 p.m. and one saw at 4 p.m., she could take judicial notice that the 4 p.m. person might have had a better view because it's lighter out at 4 p.m., right? So the fact that it gets dark at night is the kind of fact that judges can take judicial notice from. They don't have to have a so-called expert come in and say, yes, the sun goes down each day, right? But it's those kinds of obvious things, right? It's darker at night. People see better with their glasses on, things like that, that are so obvious. And so what happened in the Gladue context is that the Supreme Court of Canada said, when it comes to colonialism, the experience under residential schools, the 60s scoop, the effects of dislocation and economic oppression and so on, these are actually part of our historical record now. And things like the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and other kinds of major governmental reports and inquiries have established that factual record. And an individual Indigenous defendant does not need to show up at her sentencing hearing and say, let me teach you, sentencing judge, about colonialism. So the judge can take judicial notice of those historic facts. That's piece number one. That's what Gladue does. Piece number two is the sentencing judge should also ask for an individual report about how those systemic factors relate to the life of this particular individual. So we know, right, that not every Indigenous person in Canada has had the same experience, right? That's obvious, right? Different communities have been differently impacted. And the legacies of colonialism impact individual lives differently. And so there should be judicial notice of the systemic established facts, but then there should also be a Gladue report about this particular person. And the, so the Gladue report is kind of like, how did those systemic, historic, constant, discriminatory things impact this person? And how is that relevant to sentencing this person? So those are the two things Gladue requires, but notice how this, the overall purpose is still to find a fit sentence, right? And that's the story, whether the person is Indigenous or the person is non-Indigenous or the person is Black or the person was raised with every advantage in life or was, you know, didn't make it past grade four. What we are doing in sentencing in Canada is trying to figure out what is this person's degree of responsibility? And that actually requires a pretty deep dive into who they are and their life and what was offered to them and what was not offered to them. And so, and that kind of answers the question of, you know, is this a race-based sentencing discount? Absolutely not. And no one has, no serious scholar or jurisprude who cares about Gladue has ever thought of it that way. But the court has had to clarify that over and over and over again, which is part of why I think Gladue has had not as much impact on, at least on rates of incarceration, is because there's been a lot, a lack of understanding about what it really is. And the ways in which it is actually very similar to a sort of standard sentencing hearing, but requires just these different pieces in order to get the relevant information for the sentencing of an Indigenous person. That was way too long of an answer, but I think it gave us some building blocks for our conversation.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's fascinating to find out the way that things sort of work together in a in this complex system. And, right. And speaking of systems, a part that you mentioned earlier was that of mandatory minimums. Now, I mean, I think it's doubtless to say that this does impact the Gladue process. Could you elaborate on that maybe?
Absolutely. And again, Kevin, you're kind of at the core of the main issues here. So mandatory minimums, let's just step back and clarify, make clear we know what these are, right? A mandatory minimum is basically a legislated sentence. Right? It's where Parliament has written into the criminal code what has to be the minimum sentence for committing a particular offense. Now, a sentencing judge might go above that sentence if the case calls for it, but this is saying you have to impose at least this much. And these are really, there's some mandatory minimums having to do with fines for impaired driving and so on, but in many cases, the mandatory minimums are sentences of incarceration. And so that obviously, that kind of thing, that legislated sentence takes away judicial ability to craft another sentence that, you know, that a judge might think is more appropriate in the circumstance. So a judge, let's just take, you know, take a real example. A judge might have in front of her an Indigenous woman who is a mother, who is taking care of both children and an aging parent. And perhaps that woman, that defendant, has committed an offense importing drugs into Canada. And she committed that offense in a context of economic desperation. She's trying to make her rent. She's trying to not lose housing where she lives with her child. And then subsequent to the commission of the offense, she has completely changed her life. Takes a long time to go from offense to sentencing in our system. We're very delayed. So let's say that took 2 or 3 years. She may have been living in the community that entire time on bail. She may be now enrolled in college. She may be have secure housing. She may, you know, there's all kinds of life circumstances that could have changed. If there's a mandatory minimum, and there has been for this particular offense on the books until a very recent case struck it down, the judge has no choice but to take this woman out of her new life, right? Her new, more secure and stable life, take her away from her children and her ailing parent, out of her housing, out of her job, out of her schooling, and put her into a federal prison where 3 years from now, she'll come out again, totally destabilized. Maybe having lost custody of her children, maybe having the trauma of a parent who died while incarcerated. I mean, there's just, and in Canada, we just think of, I think the people who actually work in the criminal justice system, which is not parliamentarians, but judges and defense counsel and crown attorneys, those people really do not want to send a person like that into custody. You know, there's that old phrase, right? Like, it's kind of like seizing defeat from the jaws of victory. So in cases where someone is doing well, where you can put their offense into context, you don't want to send that person into custody. And mandatory minimum said, too bad, judge, you have to. Now, you can understand why mandatory minimums come along. I think there's a sense in the public, and maybe this is people who don't have a lot of experience with the criminal justice system, that judges are too lenient sometimes, or that judges maybe are discriminatory, that maybe they give racialized defendants a sentence of incarceration for a particular offense, but then they let people who look like them or who look like their buddies off, right? And there is actually a sense that that happened a fair bit in impaired driving contexts. And so mandatory minimums can be a way of insisting on equal treatment. And in that way, you know, we can kind of go, oh yeah, that maybe is important to ensure that judges can't just do whatever they want, right? And there could be a sort of bias that we don't want in the system. So those are some of the debates that go on around mandatory minimums. And in terms of your question, which is don't mandatory minimums kind of sit in some tension with Gladue sentencing? Absolutely. Because Gladue sentencing said, think about the circumstances of this person and whether what brought them into the criminal justice system was really way beyond their control in terms of discrimination and trauma, state-imposed trauma, and so on. And many people thought, yeah, mandatory minimums are totally invalid when a judge is precluded from considering Gladue. And the good news is that there's a very recent case from the Ontario Court of Appeal called Sharma, which basically said exactly that. That in this case, it was a conditional sentence, but it was basically a rule in legislation about what kind of sentence a person can and can't get. And what the Ontario Court of Appeal said was, in the circumstances of this Indigenous woman, where there were very strong Gladue factors, the legislated limit on the judge's sentencing discretion violates the charter. So I think there's real implications from that kind of analysis for the validity of mandatory minimums. And I know, Kevin, you're in first year, so you don't know all the charter jurisprudence quite yet, but just take my word for it that many people have noted the tension between mandatory minimums and Gladue. And there are some really strong arguments based on the charter that they're invalid. And a few of them, case called Nur, another case called Boudreaux, where basically legislated rules, and another case called Lloyd, these are all Supreme Court of Canada cases, have said that those mandatories do violate the charter. But we haven't squarely had a Supreme Court of Canada case yet that says it violates the charter because of Gladue. And so we may get that down the road. Sorry, that was a lot of law I just threw at you, but...
Yeah, I think the best part of being like a 1 hour is there's all this information that you just get to, you know, absorb and then see what stays, you know?
Well, honestly, Kevin, your instincts about what are the important questions here are right on. So you may not know some case names and so on, but I think you're going to be getting there very soon.
Well, thank you. I mean, I guess like a follow-up question about that then, also regarding the legal system, is I feel like a lot of people don't really understand the fact that, you know, paralleling our legal system is the Indigenous legal system, but it's focused more on restorative justice. And I was wondering if maybe you could speak to how that differs from our judicial system.
Yeah, you know, I want to first say that I'm not an expert in restorative justice and that there are other people who are. And so I would really defer to others for whom this is sort of a central part of their scholarship and their work. I guess the only thing I would say there is that one thing I have learned over the years from people like Val Napoleon and other scholars of Indigenous law is that there's a lot of variety in Indigenous communities across the country as to sort of how they traditionally handled what we would call criminal offending. And that, you know, there's been, as you may know, sort of a renaissance in sort of recovering Indigenous legal orders that have, you know, long predated the legal order that is the dominant one in Canada. You know, what restorative justice looks like, what justice looks like, what sentencing and sanctioning and sort of techniques of imposing social order look like in various Indigenous communities across Canada is extremely varied. And that, you know, I think in a way we sort of, in a way have a somewhat stereotypical view of all Indigenous communities being committed to restorative justice and sort of neglecting how some of these communities have dealt in the past with the problem of violence and so on. And that there's, yeah, just great work being done to recover those complex and sophisticated legal orders. But certainly restorative justice is a big part as well. And I think one way in which there is a real bridge is when it comes to GLADU sentencing, one of the really important things in GLADU is that the sentencing judge is supposed to consider whether incarceration is a culturally appropriate sanction. And what other culturally appropriate sanctions might be more appropriate for this particular person. So that tells us that a GLADU report should include that information as well. Where are they from? Right? The answer to that question of what a culturally appropriate sanction is going to depend the community they're coming from, right? And it really requires GLADU report writers to go into a community and find out, you know, how do you guys handle this kind of thing? What do you want to do? Are there restorative justice models that you should tell the judge about that you'd like to be a part of or that you could oversee? Right. And so I think that's a bridge that is supposed to be traveled, and it doesn't always happen.
It's really interesting to think about how, again, there's variation within there and how, again, it goes back to this concept of fit sentencing and how there needs to be that variation and going back again to mandatory minimums. Now, again, going back to for all that, even when we started this discussion about how a lot of our viewers might have misconceptions about the legal system just based off the way it's often portrayed in media and TV. So we're used to this sort of prolific image of the prosecutor going for the harshest sentence, and that's because it's a part of our legal system, the adversarial system. Now, do you think that that's partially to blame for like a harshness in sentencing? Or do you think it's just a byproduct of the system itself?
Well, so there's a lot going on in that question, so I'm going to try and take some pieces apart. So prosecutors, you mentioned prosecutors. Is the problem that they're always, you know, or this like cultural notion of the prosecutor as someone who's always going for the toughest sentence. I actually think that's a pretty poor description of Canadian prosecutors. We could talk about our friends to the south, and maybe that's a more apt description of prosecutorial culture in maybe the U.S. federal and some state jurisdictions. In Canada, and this is something I really stress, as all my 1L criminal law students know, I stress this a lot in my teaching. In Canada, there's really two things that should govern all decision-making by Crown prosecutors and that do govern. And that is, of course, one, the likelihood of a conviction is supposed to govern decisions like whether and what to charge, whether and when to seek a stay of proceedings, and so on. The other thing that governs every single decision a Crown prosecutor makes in Canada is the public interest. And that's supposed to, so every decision they make, right? And that's whether and what to charge, whether and, you know, conditions of bail, decisions made in the course of trial, sentencing submissions, all of that, the prosecutor is supposed to constantly be thinking about the public interest, not about the need to secure the longest sentence or the toughest punishment. And I actually think that this isn't just lip service in Canada, I think that is the culture of our Crown prosecutors and that they do understand their role that way. I'm sure there are exceptions as there are in any sort of large institution, but I think our Crown prosecutors in Canada do think of their work that way. And look at, they make so many decisions on a daily basis that are about under enforcement of the criminal law, right? They're constantly deciding not to pursue prosecutions, even though they have a case where they could secure a conviction because they don't think it's in the public interest. They're constantly making that kind of decision. And they've had to make some tough decisions that way during COVID, right? Because of capacity issues in the courts and so on. And that's perfectly appropriate. We have a system that's actually where the criminal law is meant to be profoundly under-enforced. We couldn't possibly aim at full enforcement of it, right? And so they're making decisions every day. And how do they make those decisions? Well, they're looking at who an offender is or who an accused person is, right? And is there any need from a public safety or, you know, other perspective to pursue this prosecution? And defense counsel do a lot of work in that space, right? Where they try to convince a Crown, listen, my guy is, you know, 20 years old. He's never done anything wrong. He's totally turned his life around. He's got a great, you know, he's got a spouse now and a baby, and you just drop it. And our Crowns do that every day. So also they offer plea bargains that don't represent the sentence they could get at the end of a trial. And they're doing that because it's important for them for efficiency purposes to be able to process cases, but also because they recognize that it's not their job to get the longest possible sentence for every person. And I think that's partly because they recognize, you know, that the notion that a longer prison sentence is going to be more socially productive is a very questionable notion, right? That's not to say they're not plenty tough in many cases, but that would hopefully be in cases where the public interest calls for more severity. So I mean, that's sort of my answer when it comes to prosecutorial culture. And I think we need to work really hard to protect and sustain that culture in Canada. And part of it is ensuring that our Crown prosecutors have a lot of independence and that there's that ethic of the public interest in Crown prosecutor offices, and that we don't politicize the work that they do. And I think we've in many ways been kind of good at that in Canada. I always tell my students, we don't really know the names of any prosecutors in Canada, right? Like, could you name one?
Definitely not. Especially.
No, I mean, I know a few at this point in my career, but, you know, I went to law school now with a few and I have them as guest speakers, but I know them personally. The average Canadian can't name a prosecutor. And I actually think that's a good thing. They should be operating in a fairly insulated, depoliticized kind of state so that they can make what might be unpopular decisions to the average Canadian that are in the public interest, you know, because it is true, and this is part of your question too, it is true that there's a sort of popular punitivism that is around these days in sort of late modern capitalist democracies like Canada. Right, there's a penal populism, and there's a big literature on this that this notion, and you can call it right wing, you can call it populism, whatever it is, this notion that people want toughness in punishment, that and so on, and there is a bit of that. You know, certainly we see politicians kind of grab onto that discourse and try to mobilize the electorate to go and vote for tough on crime and so on. I think there's a really mixed story in Canada about how successful that has been. But I think what's really important is to ensure that our actual institutions that carry out criminal justice law and policy are insulated from that kind of penal populism. And I think in Canada, we are largely. And that explains why, you know, during Stephen Harper's 10 years as prime minister, he did all kinds of, and his party passed all kinds of legislation that was meant to toughen up the criminal law. And what we saw during that period was that our rate of incarceration actually stayed quite steady. The system became more unequal. Racial inequality got worse under the conservative decade. But the overall rate of incarceration actually was very steady. And a lot of people were quite surprised by that. And I think one of the answers is that our actual actors and institutions, crown prosecutors, judges, parole boards, and so on, they are fairly insulated, and certainly a lot more insulated from popular pressure than in the United States. Again, a pretty complicated answer to your question, but hopefully some points in there that are useful.
No, like, absolutely. I agree with like all of it. I think it's important to recognize this difference between perception and reality. Oftentimes, you know, like we talked about the way media and the way we see things, they're not always exactly how they are because we don't see a lot of things. I think it makes a good transition to the next portion of the show where we're going to address like common critiques. You've already mentioned your views on the fact that some people have seen Gladue reports as a race-based discount on sentencing. A follow-up one that many critics have of the process is that there's variation in the way it's implemented. Can you elaborate on why there's such variation within the system?
Yes, and I think the variation is probably the most important thing to say about Gladue and where we're at with the Gladue project right now. And by variation, what we're really meaning is regional variation. So the way Gladue works in Ontario is quite frankly very different from how it works in Saskatchewan. And why is that? Well, part of it is the courts have treated the topic somewhat differently in Saskatchewan. The Saskatchewan Court of Appeal jurisprudence looks different, I think, than the Ontario Court of Appeal jurisprudence. But another hugely important thing is that in Ontario, there is legal aid funding for the production of Gladue reports. And you have an entity like Aboriginal Legal Services in Toronto, which has been the absolute leader in the Gladue litigation and in the setting up the sort of apparatus to ensure that Gladue reports are carefully done, thoughtfully done, and that they do more good than harm. So what does that mean? Well, if you do a Gladue report poorly, the person can actually look more dysfunctional and more risky. Right. If all you do is put in a Gladue report, well, they didn't get past grade 8 and their parent was an alcoholic. You know, that looks like someone who's maybe never going to have a job and who has all kinds of trauma. And I think a sentencing judge, if she has a Gladue report like that, she might, you know, it could actually work against the person. So, and Gladue reports can be done when they're done by probation officers who are not Indigenous people and have had no training and don't go into Indigenous communities to learn any history and so on. Right. And that is basically how they're done in Saskatchewan. Then it's not going to be a meaningful process. So you need to tell a story in a Gladue report that doesn't just name the bad things that have happened to this person. And people are more than the bad things that have happened to them. And, you know, any person who has these stories has also stories of resilience, right? And things they have overcome and periods in life where they've done well and family relations they have that are positive and insight they have into their trauma that could be transformative, right? And any human life, you dig in, you will see the pain, but you will also see the extraordinary capacities that someone has. And how we tell these stories really shapes how a judge is going to think of this person, what she's going to write in her sentencing decision, what the correctional system is then going to learn about this person or not learn, And so the quality of Gladue reporting is huge. And it can be done in ways that is actually harmful to the defendant. And so we need to have funding, and we need to have the skill set like the staff at Aboriginal Legal Services has. And this can't just be another thing that we ask probation officers who do a pre-sentence report to throw in a couple of paragraphs about whether this person has a relative who went to residential school. That is not how you do this. And so, you know, I've heard someone say, Gladue is something that Saskatchewan judges say before they send someone to prison. And that is kind of a not funny joke that is meant to sort of capture how superficially done it can be. And that's something we need to address in Canada very seriously, because we are not supposed to have a Saskatchewan criminal law. We have a federal criminal law system. And while there is some space for regional differences, you know, that is actually not how our system is supposed to work. And whether you're an Indigenous person being sentenced in Saskatchewan or Newfoundland or British Columbia or Ontario, I think our constitutional arrangements require that you receive the same quality of attention to basically what are equity-seeking grounds, right? Your status as an Indigenous person and the experience of colonialism and discrimination, you know, that shouldn't get shorter shrift in the prairies than it does in Ontario. So regional variation is huge. And I had a student actually at Queen's, Alexandra Hebert, who wrote a paper in my class and then actually got it published in the Queen's Law Journal, which is, you know, the standard everyone should be aiming for with their course papers. And she writes about exactly this topic. So Alexandra Hebert, check out her article on regional variation and Gladue reporting in the Queen's Law Journal.
Very inspiring response, actually. I think it's often forgotten that even though we're trying to make an effort to do good, sometimes it can go wrong. And it largely is based off variation and even funding. We're going to come back to that in a bit. A follow-up question is specifically regarding the rising rate of incarceration amongst the Indigenous community. Statistically speaking, the rate at which Indigenous women are being sentenced to prison is much higher than that of men. Like, what are your thoughts on this phenomenon?
Yeah. So again, it's such a hugely important topic. And so let's make sure that we get the numbers down. Okay. So let's look at what happened between 2009 and 2018. There was a 72% rate of increase in the population of Indigenous women in federal custody. So that's those sentences longer than 2 years. So that's a huge rate of increase, right? 72%. The system got 72% bigger for Indigenous women. And what that meant actually was that Indigenous women became about 40% of the federal women's prison population. So almost half the federal women's prisons are Indigenous women, even though they account for about 2% of the Canadian population. So that's a rate of overrepresentation that is like extraordinary, right? And it's worse than the situation for men. But, okay, so that's all very important. The trajectory of change is bad. It's also very important, and this is often not included in these conversations, to talk about what the overall numbers are. Right? It's not just the rate of change that matters. It's also what that rate of change represents. So 72% increase meant moving from 169 women to 291 women from 2009 to 2018. And while that rate of increase is very bad, I want to emphasize that I think that number remains fairly small for a country with 30 some million people in it. And why do I emphasize that? Well, I think if all you read was the headlines about how you know, there's so many Indigenous women incarcerated. It's a huge percentage of the federal prison population. The average Canadian is taking away from that a portrait of Indigenous women as extremely dysfunctional. And I think that there are many downsides to that. Obviously, it's extremely untrue for starters. And it is still, I think, a fairly small number. And I think that's important to recognize that of all the terrible things that have been done to Indigenous communities and Indigenous women and families, that the number of incarcerated women in the federal system remains under 300 people is, I think, in some ways a real achievement and a reminder of their resilience and the ways in which these women and these communities are recovering and doing well and building back. And I think those positive stories are important as well. And I think it tells us as well that getting that number down is so achievable, is so achievable. And so I think it's just important to have both of those conversations at the same time. You know, when you look at the United States, you know, they have something like 200,000 women in custody. And just that rate of incarceration is so much higher than what we have in Canada, especially with respect to women. And so I think that when it comes to women's incarceration, abolition is a real possibility. And it's important to think back to where we were just 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, we had only one federal women's prison in the entire country. And it was down the street from where I'm sitting right now, the prison for women in Kingston, and its capacity was something like 180. So maybe it was overcrowded at times, but that was about how many women we had in federal custody in Canada until it closed in, what was that, 1999 or 2003 or somewhere around there. And it was obviously good that it closed. That was a result of the Arbour Inquiry, and it was a very problematic, terrible place where people lost their lives, and there was a great many terrible things that happened there. And it's good that it closed, but a lot of the growth that we've seen in women's incarceration actually flows from the closing of P4W. Why? Because there was a sense at that time that we should have regional facilities so that women could be incarcerated closer to their families. I mean, it was so hard for women. A woman from Saskatchewan is sent to Kingston to serve a federal sentence, whereas men would be sent half an hour from where their families live so that they could have visits. I mean, it was a terrible discriminatory thing to send all women to Kingston. But as we developed regional facilities, which we now have, they had capacity, and so the system grew. And so part of the growth in women's incarceration, and this is for Indigenous women as well, is the growth in penal capacity that flowed from the closing of P4W. And so it's just important to keep all of this in mind as we think about what is possible in terms of abolition, and also what that rate of growth for Indigenous women and women generally is really telling us.
That's incredible to hear and even think about, because oftentimes you're right, we don't look at the actual numbers, because oftentimes it's hard to find the actual numbers as well. And right. I think you are correct in that it is important that we see them and discuss them. Now, I'd like to tie it into another critique of Gluty reports, and that's the fact that some argue that a positive impact could be created in reducing the rate of incarceration amongst Indigenous women if we address the four specific areas, in that of poverty, parenting, displacement, and violence. I think it speaks to what you were mentioning about being separated from family and how that can have an impact, especially amongst, for example, a mother who is the sole provider for her children, and how that might be factored in. I'm just curious to know, like, what your thoughts on this would be.
So I think that in Canada, we really need to protect this notion that sentencing should involve a very deep dive into the life of the person being sentenced, and that the offense they committed is an important part of the sentencing, but so is their life circumstances, and so is the collateral consequence consequences of any sentence that will be imposed. And luckily, the law is completely in support of what I just said. The law in this area is clear that you do look at collateral consequences, which includes the impact on family and on children of incarceration. The law is clear that you take a deep dive into circumstances of the offender, and that where circumstances are mitigating, the judge should consider it, and it doesn't even have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Like, we're supposed to take a very discretionary, open approach to circumstances of the offender. And that's allowed in any case except where there's a legislated limit on sentencing, like a mandatory minimum or a limit on conditional sentences and so on. So I think circumstances like I'm a parent, I'm a sole provider of care for a child. You know, I myself am a product of family separation because of state policies with respect to Indigenous children. You know, I'm in economic dire straits. All those kinds of things are properly part of sentencing. And why do they not always come up, or why is there not always careful attention? Well, sometimes it's because defense counsel maybe didn't have the time or resources to dive in, that sentencing can be a bit perfunctory, especially for less serious kinds of cases. And so there are, the law is clear that all of that should be considered, and that all of it really is likely to be mitigating, right? And maybe suggest the need for a non-custodial sanction or not, and so on. But do we always do that really careful work at sentencing? For various institutional reasons, no.
That's a lot to process, really, especially given all the factors. Before we go to the next question, even dragging on with the topic of sentencing, I was wondering if you could maybe give us a brief little, you know, explanation of how bail works in the sentencing process.
Yeah, so I should say there are others who are stronger bail scholars than me, but basically there's a presumption in our system that you should be released pending trial, and that you should not be subject to incarceration when you are presumed innocent. But there are three grounds that a judge may take into consideration, or a justice of the peace may take into consideration, in deciding whether to order pretrial custody, to impose pretrial custody. One of them is whether the person is likely to show up at trial. So if you have a history of not showing up, that's bad. second, whether public safety requires detention. So that's going to be looking at, what are you accused of? Are you, you know, and given the strength of the case against you, is there a risk to public safety if you're released pending your trial? And again, you could wind up looking at someone's past in order to make that assessment, and also the strength of the case against them. And then the third is called the tertiary ground. It's basically thinking, how will public perceptions of the justice system be affected by your either release or detention? So that's kind of a catch-all that looks at public perception. So there's been a lot of litigation around this, and there's a very widespread sense that pretrial custody has been overly used, excessively imposed. Something like 60-some percent of our provincial jails in Ontario are remand prisoners, people awaiting trial, rather than people who have been sentenced. And so the Supreme Court of Canada, in a number of important cases, Antic and more recent ones, Zora, other ones that are having to do with access to pretrial release, the conditions upon which pretrial release is granted, which can often be very onerous, and people wind up committing the offense of breaching their conditions because of how onerous they are. So there's a really important and robust kind of debate and litigation happening around these topics. But I would say your ability to access pretrial release is hugely important, because not only is it, you know, conditions in our provincial jails are very bad, and it's much better to be at home in order to be able to focus on your trial, maybe keep your job, keep your family together. And also when it comes to sentencing, if you are eventually found guilty or you plead guilty, if you're in the community leading up to your sentencing, you're able to show things like community ties and employment and family and so on. If you're sitting in a chaotic pretrial facility, you're not going to be able to show any of that. So it's probably going to have a big impact on your sentence moving forward. So there's a lot going on that front.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were talking about the factors that sort of determine if an individual is, you know, to be held. But can we talk about maybe the factors that go into if an individual is eligible to make bail and how that process works?
Well, I think the way it's supposed to work is that you're actually, the presumption is that you're supposed to be released.
Okay.
You haven't been convicted of a crime. So it's really up to the Crown to say why you should not be released. Right? So that, and I, as I understand it, the Supreme Court of Canada has had to constantly remind players in the system that that's the starting point. The starting point is release, and there's some different rules in the criminal code for different offenses about when presumptions and so on, but I won't get into all of that. But the starting point here is that you are innocent, and that does not change until you either plead guilty or are found guilty after a trial. So you're supposed to be able to go home. It's really the burden is on the Crown to say, to show that one of these three factors, you know, militates in favor of detention. So you have to show they're not going to show up at trial. There's a public safety concern, or there's a public perception in terms of administration of justice. So the burden really is on the state to justify pretrial detention.
And does that overlap at all with the Gladue framework? Does that impact it? Is it taken into account during these decisions, or?
Right. So there's two things to say about that. One is that Gladue is not just a sentencing rule. It is supposed to, and there's lots of law on this now, it is supposed to affect every decision made in the criminal justice system. And that includes in the prison context as well. Right. So if you're making a decision about transferring an Indigenous inmate to maximum security from medium, you're supposed to consider the Gladue factors. Right. So it's not just for sentencing. It started there, but the law is clear now. The courts have developed it. It's supposed to apply at all kinds of different stages, including bail. But it has a Gladue report been produced at that stage? Probably not. And if the person's never been involved in the criminal justice system before, there won't be one in their file, and they may not be even aware of their Gladue factors. This is the thing. It's important to recognize that you're 19, you're 20 years old, you grew up, you had your family. You may not really even be aware of what your relatives went through, of why your home was the way it was growing up, of how your community was affected by state policies. I mean, what 19 or 20 year old really understands that much about their family and their community? It often takes a lifetime to learn really where your parents were coming from and to learn their stories and where your grandparents were coming from and how the way that your grandparents parented your parents affected your relation with your parents. I mean, this is all stuff people spent their entire adult lives in therapy trying to figure out. And so the defendant at a bail or a pretrial, you know, detention hearing is maybe not going to be in a position to introduce any of this evidence. And so it's like, does the Gladue framework apply? Absolutely. But will the decision maker have a shot at getting that information? Maybe, maybe not.
even expanding on that, with the obvious cost of legal fees and the amount of effort to put into actually crafting one, and you were mentioning before, but crafting a positive one that does what it's supposed to do, and all of that effort, do you ever think that it almost represents just another barrier or a brass ring that's just out of reach in a lot of context for the justice to be served?
Yeah. I think that, well, it's important to make clear that a judge has a duty to consider glad do factors regardless of whether counsel even raised them. And that comes from the glad do decision from the Supreme Court of Canada. And so that duty on the trial judge, on the sentencing judge, is there regardless of like the adversarial system. So if a judge is sentencing someone and it may be that an Indigenous defendant never raises any of this, right? And it may be the judge doesn't know the person is Indigenous. And, you know, the whole thing just proceeds without any discussion or attention. And so fine, that's one type of possibility. But if the judge is aware the person is Indigenous, she then has a duty to inquire. And unless the defendant waives his or her rights to have those factors considered, explicitly waives them, says, no, judge, I don't want that information as part of my hearing today. And that does happen. Then the judge has the duty to inquire, and she needs to do whatever it takes to get the information. So she should pause the hearing, ask counsel or the Crown or whoever to produce a pre-sentence report, call it a glad do report, call it whatever you want, but that information needs to get in front of the judge so that she can fulfill her duty. And that's a duty she doesn't have with respect to other defendants. That is a difference between sentencing an Indigenous person and sentencing, say, a Black or non-Indigenous person, is that it's this independent duty on the part of the judge. In those other types of cases, it's all going to flow from the adversarial system and whether counsel raises particular issues or doesn't. The judge herself isn't going to have a responsibility in other cases. So, and that's a responsibility that flows from the special relation between the state and Indigenous people historically and so on. That's just important to say here. Yeah, there's important funding issues, but the duty is actually on the judge to get the information. And yes, I think that in some ways, in some jurisdictions, the glad do framework has done more hurt than good, has harmed more than it has helped. Because number one, it creates this general social sense that Indigenous people are getting some kind of discount, which is false, but still creates, maybe contributes to sort of a racist culture at large. This sort of notion that they're getting something extra, some bonus, some discount, some special treatment, right? This kind of discourse is definitely remains in Canada, unfortunately. And so it may be that the glad do regime contributes to that racist discourse while also not helping many, many, many people. And that all things, you know, you add that up, it could be a negative overall. So it's really important to do a few different things, correct the discourse, understand how this works and correct people who describe it wrong. And there are lawyers and law professors who don't understand it. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there. There are judges who don't understand it, who've been overturned by appellate courts because they don't understand it. And we need to make sure that the resources and institutions are there to make it a meaningful regime.
It's very well put. You know, as our interview's, you know, winding down, I have an English degree, you know, I try to sneak that
Me
into
too.
Everything. Again, wow, you got to take your class next year then, you know. I got a soft spot for really good quotes, and I feel like in your piece, Our Obligations at Sentencing, there's just this really eloquent, beautiful quote. I'm going to read it right now, and I was wondering if you could just elaborate on it after. So in your piece, you mentioned that in Canadian law, both generally and at sentencing, there's an understanding that uniform hides inequity. So could you please just unpack that? There's a lot that goes into that small sentence. And I think it would just really sum up this entire interview.
Yeah. So yeah, the idea there is that uniformity hides inequity. And I'm really, there are many philosophers and judges and others who've had this idea. I wish I could take credit for it, but I'm really echoing a view that is very deep in the literature on equality, and that is very very well recognized in Supreme Court jurisprudence on sentencing in Canada. So what it means is, so uniformity, what does uniformity mean? It means treating everyone as if they came from the same place, as if they had a uniform life experience, right? And that if we just, that sounds like equality, right? Let's just treat everyone the same, right? And there are people who really fall for this line of thinking, this notion that formal equality, acting as if everyone started in the same position, is sort of the best way. And that kind of uniform approach, acting as if we all started in the same position, hides inequity. It actually hides discriminatory treatment, because the reality is we didn't all come from the same place. And not only that, the reason that some groups had different starting points is because of state misconduct, right? And that is really what is going on in Gladue, a recognition that the reason Indigenous people wind up involved at a disproportionate rate with the criminal justice system is because of the direct consequences of the colonial state project. And so if we then turn around at sentencing and say to Indigenous people, I'm not going to think about any of that stuff that the very state that is now sentencing you did to you, right? I'm just going to act like, you know, you were a blank slate before you committed this offense. And now I'm just going to say, well, you committed this type of offense with these type of offense features. So you, the sentence for that is 7.5 years. See you later. And, you know, someone else comes along who experienced none of that state treatment and who committed their offense in very different circumstances, might have even had all kinds of privilege and opportunity in their lives, and notwithstanding that, committed an offense with these features. And we're just going to say that's also 7.5 years. I think it doesn't really take much moral creativity or imagination to sort of say, you know, there's something more wrong about doing something bad when you had the option to do something else, right? I mean, I'm a parent of a toddler, so I every single day have to like figure out how to create a moral framework that I can communicate to my child. And anytime I get, you know, he's in trouble, the first thing he does is say, well, I did that because of this. Like I said, I was going to punch you because you wouldn't let me make a bracelet. And instead you had said I had to go have a bath. That was just happened last night. What is going on with that? Because, right, he's 3.5 years old and he knows that in explaining or justifying or trying to give context to why he said, I'm going to punch you, right? He knows that is it. That's in our list of things we never say. We have that phrase, things we never say. And he says, but I breached that rule about what we never say because. And he's then saying, because I was frustrated, I wanted to do this other thing, you know, and it's a in that particular fact pattern, it was a very terrible justification saying, you know, I threatened violence because I wanted to do something else and you stood in my way. That's not a good defense. That's not a good sentencing submission. Right. But the, because that's what sentencing is all about. We let people put forward a because. Right? Don't just analyze my conduct in isolation. Conduct doesn't exist in isolation, right? People's behavior flows from their life and what they were taught and their psychology, their families, their parenting, also their innate, you know, disposition and so on. And a sentencing hearing, a good one, a thoughtful one, and a morally just one is going to consider all of that as best it can. It's not going to just say, well, you committed this offense, and I'm going to give you the same sentence as the guy who was here yesterday who committed that offense. That kind of uniformity, it's superficially appealing, right? It looks like uniformity. You got the same sentence for the same offense. But no, it hides gross inequity because we refuse to think about the because. And a 3.5-year-old can intuit that the because is an important move. He's kind of bad at what follows. I'm sure he'll get much better as years go by and I'll have more to deal with. But he gets that the because, that explaining conduct is a really important moral move. And so that's kind of what I'm talking about there and or what I'm alluding to. And it's a very deep idea that's well recognized in Canadian law that has to do with substantive equality.
Wonderfully put. I think that concludes our interview for today.
Kevin, I have to say that your questions were just some of the most thoughtful that I've ever encountered on this topic. And I can't believe you're only in first year law school, and you're just right up there in terms of the high quality of students that we get at Queen's. And I'm really looking forward to getting to know you more as you are doing upper year classes.
Thank you. I can't wait to take more classes, in all honesty. I'm riled up now.
Especially because you might get to take those classes in person.
Well, fingers crossed. Yeah. But thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today. And it's been really insightful to get your point of view on these subjects and just, you know, educate all of us. You know, I'd like to thank you for your time, for joining us. And, you know, just from Pro Bono Radio, thank you again. And to all the listeners out there, thank you for tuning in. We greatly appreciate all of this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Before we end the show, I'd like to remind everyone that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or of Queen's University's Faculty of Law. As previously mentioned, this document was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's University's Law Student Volunteers. PBSC volunteers are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. This document contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Today's show is produced by Queen's Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Kiss. If you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website. Thank you for tuning in and have a great day.